bit of review here as we get started. So let's just get right into the notes then in the introduction. So last week in lesson 171, we looked at the physical description and contents of BOD 1602. In doing so, we observed the following regarding this document. Now, I just want to remind you what we're talking about here, okay? When we talk about BOD 1602, this is what we're referring to. This is the Bodleian Library website, and this is the image of the document that they have released for public viewing. They only have one image released, which is frustrating, but it is what it is. So this is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten alterations of the translators actually written on the physical pages. You can see words are crossed out. You can see there's overwriting. There's things written in the margin. And so what we see here is their actual draft work as they are following rule number one, to follow the Bishop's Bible unless the truth in the original says otherwise. So this is a document that is in the Bodleian Library. It's known simply as BOD 1602. It's a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Its short abbreviation, BOD, is related to the Bodleian Library, the library that houses the document. We saw last Sunday a lot of information about that, and it looks like it's been erased. But if we go to the notes, look at the first open bullet point there under point number one. I'm going to go back over here for the sake of following along. This document is in the possession of the Bodleian Library at Oxford University. It was first logged in the library's possession in 1646, so we talked about that last time. BOD 1602 is a complete 1602 Bishop's Bible containing Genesis through Revelation, as well as the Apocrypha. So it's a complete Bible bound together. It's got everything from Genesis to Revelation, including the Apocrypha. So it has everything that would have been included within a 1611 King James Bible. Portions of the document are heavily annotated, whereas other portions have no annotations. NA is what I abbreviated there, whatsoever. So we look here, this is 2 Chronicles 17 in this picture right here, and we can see that it's annotated. There are other portions of it that have no annotations in it at all. And we can designate those portions here with this list that I have. So if we look at this, Genesis 1:1 through Isaiah 4 verse 6 have annotations. Isaiah 4 verse 7 through 66 verse 24, or the end of the book, have no annotations. Jeremiah 1:1 through 4:31 have annotations. Jeremiah 5:1 through 52 verse 34 and Lamentations have no annotations. Daniel 1:1 through 4:7 have annotations. Daniel 5 to the end do not have any annotations. Hosea chapter 1 verse 1 through the end of the Old Testament and Malachi 4:6 have annotations. The apocryphal section has none. Matthew chapter 1 verse 9 through Luke chapter 24 verse 53 have annotations, while John chapter 1 verse 1 through chapter 15 have no annotations. John 16:1 through the end of John 21 through verse 25 have annotations, and then Acts through Revelation have none. So it's a, depending on what part of it you're looking at, you might encounter annotations, you might not. The Old Testament and the Gospels are the most heavily annotated parts of it, okay? And again, that is because these sheets, remember what I talked to you last Sunday, when the king authorized the project, the king's printer printed 40 unbound copies of a 1602 Bishop's Bible, and then they were distributed to the translational companies. So here's a 1602 Bishop's Bible. You can see that it looks very similar. Well, it is. It's identical to what you would see here on this image. Now, this is a different page, but they were given 40 unbound copies to do their work on. And then at the end of the project, they were gathered up and they were bound together in this document called BOD 1602. So not all of it is annotated in the document, okay? So, next point. Originally written on unbound sheets from the 40 unbound copies of the 1602 Bishop's Bible provided by Robert Barker, the various sections found in BOD 1602 were collected and bound in their present form. Many of the annotations disappear into the binding, thereby indicating they were originally unbound when the annotations were added, right? So we talked about that last time. I believe we could see that here. Yes. So see here that these annotations are disappearing into the margin, or into the binding, I should say. That's because when they were written on this page, it was not what? It was not bound. When the leaves were gathered up for binding, then some of the notes disappeared into the margin, like we can see here, indicating that they were originally written on unbound sheets, which is completely consistent with what we know about the king's printer and what he did as far as the providing the different translational companies with the unbound copies. One professional secretary is responsible for the annotations found in the Old Testament, whereas three different scribes, three different hands, made annotations at three different stages in the New Testament section. So we're going to talk about both sections before we're done looking at this document. We're going to look at the Old Testament today, and then eventually we'll talk about the New Testament sections as well. The Old Testament annotations are believed to represent a late stage in the overall project to revise the bishop's Bible, whereas the New Testament annotations are believed to be indicative of an earlier stage in the overall project. So, the top page two. In this lesson, we want to focus our gaze on the Old Testament. So before we get into the Old Testament part of this, does anybody have any questions or comments about the review from last week? All right. If not, then let's get right into our main point today, which is to start looking at the Old Testament. All right. So point number one here. The scholar who has done the most work on the Old Testament text of Bot 1602 is Edward Jacobs. Jacobs is the author of the following doctoral thesis, as well as essays in scholarly journals. So I have all three of these. I brought them with me if you want to check them out. The first one is from 1972, A Bodleian Bishop's Bible, 1602, a preliminary study of the Old Testament annotations and their relationship to the authorized version. This is a copy of the doctoral dissertation. I was able to pay some money and download this off some websites, okay? And one of the interesting things about this is that there are some additional images at the end of the pages of the Bodleian Bible that are not released online. So you can see these are heavily annotated pages with the handwritten notations of the translators in the margin, and these are just from different sections of it that he did discuss in his doctoral thesis. So it's interesting to have access to this for that reason, because you get to see more information than what is available on the website. So the first document is this one from 1972, which is his doctoral thesis, okay? The second one is an Old Testament copy text. This one's from 1975, an Old Testament copy text for the 1611 Bible, and this was in the paper of the Bibliographic Society of America from 1975, and then a third one from 1980, two stages of Old Testament translation for the King James Bible, and this was in a periodical known as The Library. So, Jacobs, far and away, has the most written documentation and material. He's done the most direct study with the actual document in front of him. He wrote about it for his doctoral dissertation, and then he wrote about it in other journals in the mid-70s and then in 1980, okay? Now, let's go look at the next point. Jacobs believes that the Old Testament annotations found in Bot 1602 are indicative of the finished work sent by the translators to the Committee of Final Review in London. Okay? So he thinks, and he'll make the case for it, we're going to look at his case over the next couple weeks, that this is the Old Testament section is the finished product that was sent to the final meeting. So these revisions in his mind are late, they are late in the game. They are late stage revisions showing you the scope of the work just before the final finishing touches were put on the King James Bible at the final review or at the general meeting. Okay? Put another way, this is the finished draft work of the two companies charged with revising the bishop's Old Testament. Jacob provides the following evidence for this assertion, quote, "This conclusion I have drawn from study of annotations in outer columns and margins of the Old Testament. Some 90% of the Old Testament annotations represent the text of the AV." So understand what he's saying here, okay? If you look at the notations that are noted here in the Old Testament section, He's saying 90% of them represent the final published text of the 1611 Bible. That is a very high percentage, which means the final review only changed about 10% of the information, okay? Which, to me, is what you would expect. If they've done a good job, there shouldn't be that much stuff that needs to be changed late in the game, okay? So let's go back to the quote. Some 90% of the Old Testament annotations represent the text of the AB. These annotations, then, are not, quote, not a scholarly collation of the text of the AB and the bishops. Neither do they represent a halfway state in the progress of translation work. They are a record of finished work which the Committee of Final Review found after scrutiny to be in nearly perfect order for the committee effected few changes in the translation that these annotations represent. Several kinds of evidence support this conclusion: the bibliographic state of the text, the annotator's hand, and the methods used to record the annotations and textual collation. So again, let's understand what he's talking about. He's talking like a scholar, but what he's essentially saying is, look, this work in Bot 1602 for the Old Testament, he's talking specifically about the Old Testament, represents the finished work of the companies that then what they turned in to the final review committee. Okay? So it is not a early dipstick. It is not a midway dipstick. It is a what? Late dipstick towards the end of the work. Okay? Only about 10% of the things are going to be further revised by the Committee of Final Review. So, and at bottom of page 2, regarding the bibliographic state of the text, Jacobs concludes, bibliographic study reveals that this Bible is a true and complete 1602 Bishop's Bible. Its text is in perfect order, save for minor printing errors and signatures, catchwords, and foliation numbering. The collation formula of this Bible agrees with the collation formula for a true bishop's Bible described by A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, top of page 3. The true and complete textual state of this bishop's Bible suggests that these annotations have a singular purpose. Such an inference would be less tenable if, for example, the annotated portions of the Old Testament were parts of different English translations rather than, as is the case, parts of one harmonious 1602 text. What that purpose is becomes clear upon examination of the annotator's hand and method used in recording these annotations. So what he's doing there is he's just getting into his justification for why he's making this claim. He's claiming that this is the work of the translators late in the game, and he's laying out his case for why he believes that to be the situation. We already noted in lesson 171, Jacob's judgments regarding the secretary hand found throughout the Old Testament annotations. He believes the text was annotated by the same professional secretary. Having already covered this point in the previous lesson, we will focus here on the annotation practices of the secretary. Okay? So what we want to talk about is how are the annotations made? Is a very, you might not observe it just looking at this, but there's a highly sophisticated, precise methodology that's being used for recording the changes that are being made to the Bishop's Bible as it is being revised into what would ultimately become the King James Bible. And that's what we want to look at throughout this lesson. All right. So look at the quote on page 3. When the annotator can make changes easily within the printed lines of the Old Testament text, he does so. So here we can look at that right here. Verse 3, you can see this is crossed out and there's a different word written above. So when he can make the revisions interlinearly or between the lines, does he do it?
Yeah.
If the revision is larger than that, so as to not fit interlinearly, he's going to make the changes where? In the margin. Okay, back to the quote. To amend a printed word, phrase, or clause, the annotator erases it with a single or sometimes double horizontal line, that part of the text he intends for sure. So I copied and pasted this, so if it sounds like it's written weird, it's because that's the way Jacobs wrote it, not because I typed it wrong, all right? If the amended reading requires that several successively printed words be erased, then the erasure usually consists of a single line, continuous horizontal line that passes through all the words he intended to erase. If the emendation consists of altering the spelling of a word by the change of a single letter, the annotator employs a diagonal line to erase a single letter. So in other words, just striking one letter and then putting it in. That's what he's saying here, all right? The line moves from the bottom left side of the letter to the top right side of the letter. Once the annotator has completed the erasure, he writes the amended reading above the erased reading. Beneath the printed line of the erased text, the annotator frequently writes a caret sign, which calls attention to the emendation. In the beginning chapters of Genesis, there are some departures from this method, but by chapter 8, the annotator has his method well established. So here's a caret sign. You can see there's a change here, indicating to go where? To the margin. Okay, there's different changes here. You can see the strike through here. In other words, that's just taken out. There's all manner. Here's a caret, the insertion of some language here. So there's a method to how this is being done. Here's a spelling issue. You can see this. I'm not sure exactly what word this is, but there's a change in spelling. There's a different letter written up here. So all of these different types of emendations are recorded as we look at this copy of the Bishop's Bible. Look at the next paragraph. The annotator does not always record his amended reading within the printed lines of the text. Annotations recorded in the inner or outer margins adjacent to the verse being amended are as frequent as those recorded within the text itself. Such marginal annotations are of a two-part sequence and always appear next to the verse to which they belong. The sequence works in this manner. With a single horizontal line, the annotator erases the verse or portion of the verse being amended. Then, above the erased text, and usually at its beginning, the annotator writes a particular sign, slightly beneath the printed line of erased text and usually near its end. The annotator often writes a caret sign. Sometimes, however, the caret comes directly beneath the particular sign that the annotator has written at the beginning of the erased text. In the margin, now, if you're getting confused, we're going to look at examples, okay? So just work with me here, and then I got four or five examples we're going to look at in this lesson. In the margin, the annotator again writes the same sign that he has written above the beginning of the erased text, and then follows the marginal sign. He writes the amended reading that is to replace the erased text. In this manner, the annotator carefully performs the erasure and indicates its beginning and end, not only with the use of the erasure line, but also with the use of a textual sign and a caret. He then makes evident the emendation by duplicating the textual sign and writing it alongside and always before the marginal emendation. He uses this procedure, whether the marginal emendation be made in the inner or outer margin, either of the recto or verso of a leaf. For inner margins of rectos, the annotator places his marginal sign nearest the outer edge of the inner margin and follows it with his marginal emendation and moves inward towards the first column of the text. For the outer margin rectos, the marginal sign comes immediately after the second column of the text and the emendation moves toward the outer edge of the recto. So what does that mean? That means if he's amending the inner column, he'll put it where? On the inner and right this way. If he's amending the outer column, he'll put it here and right out toward the margin. So he's just describing the manner in which the annotator is making what? Is making the annotations. So if he's amending this column, the right column, he's not going to put it where? On the inner margin, he's going to put it where? On the outer margin. If he's amending the inner column, he's going to put the emendations where? In the inner margin. Okay, next paragraph. For emendations demanding only the addition of words, phrases, or clauses to a verse, and requiring no erasure of the text, the annotator employs one or the other of the methods just described. He may simply write a caret sign just below or above the printed line of text where he intends to place the annotation. Then above the caret sign, the annotator can either write the emendation to be added or he can write a sign. If a sign, he writes a corresponding sign in the margin and follows it with the annotation that the text requires. So, is everybody following that, what he's saying there? So understand, when you look at this document, are you looking at the work in progress of the translators as they are doing the work? You absolutely are. That's what you're looking at. Okay? Their notes written out by a professional scribe on the text of a 1602 bishop's Bible. Okay? So let's start looking at some examples now. Anybody have any questions before we move on? Alright, Numbers 15:28. So I'm gonna pull this up here, make sure I'm on the right spot. Alright, so next, Jacobs uses Numbers 15:28 as an example of how the annotator transformed the 1602 bishop's text into what would become the 1611 King James reading. The following image is of Numbers 15 as it appears in a 1602 bishop's Bible. So this first image, notice it, all I did is take a screenshot of the page. You guys know, I've told you this before, that I've been able to locate and pull from the internet a 1602 Bishop's Bible. So what I've done here in this particular image, this first image, is all I've done is found that verse, zoomed in on it, and took a screenshot of the verse as it appears in the Bishop's Bible. Okay? Look at the next statement. The next image of Numbers 15:25. The next image is of Numbers 15:25 as it appears in Bot 1602 according to the description of Jacob's annotations. Okay? Now, let's look at what we have here. Alright? Now, notice a few things. I'm going to point it out to you and then we'll read about it here in a second. So notice, this word here, ignorantly, is what? Crossed out. Alright? Notice there's a caret sign. Or sorry, there's a double line here. So if you follow the double line, the same line is where? In the margin. Where you have the substitution. Thorough ignorance. So when they do the first, when they are amending this text, do they make a change from ignorantly to thorough ignorance in the margin? Shake your head yes, that's what they're doing. Okay. And then we have this removal here. And we have a half moon with a strike above it, where we have the amended reading to make atonement for him. So what we see here are the different annotations as this text is being conformed or changed or revised into what would be the King James, okay? So annotations in the outer margin of the recto adjacent to the verse are what is down here. So imagine you have the verse here, it's on the outer margin, which means it's on the right-hand column. You would have this double strike line here, and then over here in the column you would have what? Thorough ignorance, you have the half moon with the line above it, and then in that margin you would have this is what they intend to be as the substitution reading. Okay, so let's go to the next page. I'm going to leave this picture up here though. The following is Jacob's description of the annotations made within the text of Numbers 15:28 in Bot 1602. Note how the changes described below correspond with the blue markings I made on the image above. Numbers 1 through 4 are annotations within the text of the verse, whereas numbers 5 and 6 are annotations in the outer margin of the recto adjacent to the verse. Okay, so let's look at what we're talking about. Ignorantly is erased with a single line. Here it is. Ignorantly is erased with a single horizontal line. Written above the letter O of the word is a textual sign of two short vertical lines, right here. Okay? Vertical parallel lines side to side. A caret is written beneath the letter Y, right here. So, do we have this, a strike through line here? Do we have the two small vertical lines above the letter O and the caret? Okay? A caret is written beneath the letter Y for this word. To reconcile him is erased with a single continuous horizontal line, right here. To reconcile him is struck through. The word to also has a second horizontal line drawn through it, right here. See, you following this? Okay. Written above the letter R is a textual sign made up of a half moon with a horizontal line tangent to it and extending on both sides of the top. A caret is written beneath the letter M. So here's the half moon, and here's the caret beneath the letter M. Right? That, the word that, where is it right here, is erased with a single horizontal line. May is erased with a single horizontal line. A caret is written beneath the letter Y, right here. The word shall is written above the word may, right here. So interlinearly. And is followed by the letter G, right here. Thorough ignorance is written preceding the first sign, right here, and that was our double strike line. So there's that. And then to make atonement for him is written preceded by the sign used in number two, which is this half moon with the line above it. Okay, so these symbols here indicate go where? To the margin. And in the margin you find what he's saying, what they're saying should be there. Okay? So, considering the annotations found in the 1602, found in Bot 1602, the amended verse reads as follows. The priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth through ignorance. When he sinneth by ignorance before the Lord, to make an atonement for him, and it shall be forgiven him. The following picture is of Numbers 15:28 as it reads in the King James Bible. So this is the way it reads in the King James Bible. And then we can go to the next page. The following table represents the text of Numbers 15:28 in the 1602 Bishops, Bod 1602, and the 1611 in parallel columns so the reader can easily observe the changes. Please note I have updated the spellings for ease of reading, okay? So what we see here, guys, is the final end product. So here's what we started with originally. And on the left, here's how it's annotated to read in Bot 1602 in the middle, and here's what ends up in your King James Bible on the right. Okay? So let's compare those things. Okay? So we're going to start at the left. So the 1602 bishop read as follows. And the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth ignorantly, when he sinneth by ignorance before the Lord to reconcile him, and that it may be forgiven him. The Bot 1602 reading, because of the emendations. And the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth thorough ignorance. That's what they had, right? So that's taking into account this change, right? Of the half moon. That's what they had, all right? You guys following this? That sinneth thorough ignorance, when he sinneth by ignorance before the Lord, to make an atonement for him, and it shall be forgiven him. And then we can look in the right-hand column at the 1611 final reading, and it says follows, reads as follows. And the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth ignorantly. What'd they just do? They went back to what? They went back, see? Sinneth ignorantly, they proposed to change thorough ignorance. Which is the better reading? Sinneth ignorantly, which is what they end up with. So, does that mean they rejected that change at the final review committee? Okay, let's keep going. So, we're reading the right-hand column. I'll start over. And the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth ignorantly when he sinneth by ignorance before the Lord to make an atonement for him, and it shall be forgiven him. Now notice the use of the ampersand sign there instead of the word what? And. Strange, but that's what they did. So you asked me about that a while back, and that is the way the print looks. You can see that right here if we go up to the image. Where'd it go?
It's on the last line, but it's not an ampersand, it's something else.
Here?
Yeah.
That's the way it looked before. It's an ampersand sign. So, to make atonement for him, and it shall be what? Forgiven him. So they use the shorthand here. Mm-hmm. All right? So, let's go to the next point. Jacobs concludes his comments by stating the following quote. The AV accepts all emendations except one. It rejects the amended reading, thorough ignorance, and prefers to restore the 1602 reading ignorantly. The letter G cited above in textual annotations four as following the word shall receives or refers to the Geneva Bible 1560, which also has the auxiliary shall at this place rather than many. So let's look at that, okay? Notice what we have, okay? Should say, I'm sorry, may, not many. So, see, may, 1602 had may, it's revised to say what?
Shall.
Is that kept in the AV?
Yes.
Yeah. So they accept all the changes made in Bot 1602 to this verse, except how many? One. They recommend changing ignorantly to thorough ignorance. They think better of that and switch it back to what? Ignorantly. All right? So textual collations such as these reveal the purpose of annotations found in Bot 1602 Old Testament, in the Bot 1602 Old Testament. They represent the revision choices of the King James Bible translators as they followed Rule 1, quote, the ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. Okay? Are they following Rule 1? Absolutely, they are following Rule 1. Any idea that they didn't follow this rule is completely false. Alright? Quote, textual collation reveals this purpose. The annotations comprise two greater and three lesser classes of amended readings. The amended reading is, an amended reading is one which incorporates all annotations at a given verse. Some verses within annotated portions of the text are unannotated. Meaning they didn't what? They didn't write anything down. They didn't change anything. That would be the same thing or the equivalent thing of what we saw in Manuscript 98 where they left something what? Blank, right? Some verses within the annotated portions of the text are unannotated. Of these, some are carried forward into the AV as they stand, while some appear in the AV amended, probably by the Committee of Final Review. The careful method of the annotator and textual collation with the AV verify that such unannotated verses are not oversights. Meaning, did they intend for that verse to just be carried forward without any what? Without any changes. Let's see if we can find an example of this here. We only have a few we can pick from just because of the nature of this. It does not appear to me. I guess there's one annotation here. But imagine this marking is in here. This verse is largely untouched. And does it sit between annotations above and annotations below? So that would be indicative then of a verse where they just accept the bishop's Bible reading without any what? Without any changes. I'm just trying to give you an example of what he's talking about. Okay. Collation of Bot 1602 with the 1611 AV establishes three main classes of amended readings in the Bodleian document according to Jacobs. The first class is described as readings where the annotations found in the 1602 bishops agree exactly with the AV. Okay. These comprise 90% of the annotations found in the Old Testament of Bot 1602. Now what does that mean? That means for 90%, class 1 is where the annotations match exactly word for word with what ended up where? In the King James Bible. 90% of all of the changes, 90% of all of the emendations found in this Bodleian document fit class 1. So again, class 1 is where the changes that are noted here cohere exactly with what ends up where? In the King James Bible. 90% of the annotations are class 1, meaning they're exact. Two more examples of class one emendations provided by Jacobs. Two more are provided by Jacobs in Psalm 10, 9 and 10, and Proverbs 27, 15. So let's look at a few more examples here. So let's just stop for a minute. I don't want you to get lost in the minutiae of all this. When we look at this, are we looking at them actually doing the work?
Yep.
You are seeing their work as they are doing it. So you don't have to sit here. The only thing you don't know is why are they making a particular change. We don't always know why they made a given change, but are we seeing what they changed as they work their way through? Now, when you know what they changed, could you sometimes figure out probably why they changed it? You certainly could, maybe not in every case, but you're looking at them actually doing the work of translating when we're looking at these things, okay? So let's look at Psalm 10, 9 and 10. So the following image is of Psalm 10, 9 and 10 as it appeared in the Bishop's Bible. So again, that's my screenshot of it there for you. Aren't you glad that we don't use that font anymore? Okay? So the following image is of Psalm 10, 9 through 10 from Bod 1602. Now listen carefully to this point. For this example, Jacobs does not provide a step-by-step description of the individual emendations like he did for Numbers 15:28. Instead, he provides the 1602 bishop's reading and the revised reading found in Bod 1602, as well as the reading found in the AV. I have added the marks in blue to allow the reader to visualize the changes. Some of the mark revisions may be in the margin, but I am not sure since Jacobs did not provide that detail. Okay? So I can show you the starting point. We can catalog interlinearly the changes that were made. I just need you to realize that some of the changes in blue might have been in the margin. I don't know. The website has not released the images of this page. But I do know the changes that were made, so I can at least record them for you on the image. So let's at least look at that, understanding that some of these might have been in the margin. So, first of all, do they remove the word for? They strike waiting and switch it to what? In wait. They remove even. They remove, I think this is lureth he into his den. They strike that. They strike may, what's that? It's hard for me to read on this. Raveth? Ravish. May ravish? They strike that and change it to lieth and wait to catch the poor. Notice, do they change the verse numbering? They remove this number as a separate verse, and do they add this to verse 9? So there's a change in the numbering here, okay? And then they strike ravish here to catch, and they change, what is that?
Geddeth
to draweth. So we can note the changes that are being made. I don't know for sure which changes may or may not have been in the margin, but can we at least note the changes that are being made here in blue? Okay? So, the Bishop's Bible, so if you look underneath here, so here's how the Bishop's Bible amended through annotations to read, he lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. That's the reading, taking into account the changes, the annotations. All right? And then we can look at the 1611, Psalm 10, 9, and then let's just go straight to the comparison table because it's easiest to see. So notice on page 8, so we start with the original reading. He lieth waiting secretly. Even as a lion lurketh he in his den, that he may ravage the poor, he doth ravage the poor when he getteth him into his net. That's what they started with. Then the center column is the reading with the revisions cataloged in Bob 1602. He, so they've gotten rid of the four, like we saw in the previous thing, he lieth in wait secretly as a lieth in his den, he lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. Have they way improved it? Is it like way better than it was when they started? And then we can look at the 1611. He lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den, he lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. So have they basically accepted all of the annotations from Bob 1602? There's a few differences in capitalization and punctuation, but is the reading essentially the same? Okay? So this final reading of the 1611 came from Bob 1602 with a bishop's Bible with the annotations recorded in Bob 1602. So when we look at that, can you literally see them transforming that verse into what would be in a 1611 Bible? Okay, now, before we look at the last one, does anybody have any questions or comments about this? Look, to me, this is unprecedented access into understanding what they did. All right? Any questions about that verse or that example? So we can look at one more then today. So all of these are category one examples. I should be clear about this, right? And what are category one examples? Category one examples are examples where the annotations in Bob 1602 show up exactly where? In the AB 1611, exactly the way they were annotated in Bob 1602. 90% of all of the verses that have annotations fit category one, the category we're talking about now. Okay? We can look at Proverbs 27:15 as another example. So again, I provided you the base starting point with this picture from a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Then we can look at the next bullet point. Proverbs 27:15 reads as follows in Bob 1602. As in the previous example, Jacob's only provides the 1602 bishops and the Bod 1602 readings for this verse. I have added the blue markings in the image below to capture the changes made to the bishop's Bible by the King James translators. Some of the readings inserted in the text could appear in the margin. All right. So, do we have a lot of changes being made here? Mm-hmm. Notice, this whole phrase is all what? Removed and substituted just for the word what? Continual. Okay? Then we have the insertion of very. Instead of a rainy day, a what? Very rainy day. I'd rather it just be a rainy day, not a very rainy day. Now, this is struck through and substituted, right? So let's look at it. So if you look here, so the Bishop's Bible amended through annotation to read, here's what it now reads in Bod 1602. A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. That's the example. Okay? Then we can look at the final here. This is the King James. A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. All right? And then we can make the comparison with the parallel columns. All right? So, we start with, in this case, in 1602, a brawling woman and the roof of the house dropping in a rainy day may well be compared together. Is that extremely clunky in its wording? It doesn't read very well, right? So with the changes, here's how it is amended to read. A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Is that much more succinct and to the point?
Yes.
And then we look at the King James 1611. And we see the reading, a continual dropping and a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Are all of the wording changes recorded in Bob 1602 accepted into the AV? Yes, the only difference again are a few punctuation changes that they make. But the wording is the same. So what's recorded here in Bob 1602 shows up exactly where? In 1611. Again, that is category one, and 90% of the verses that are amended in Bod 1602 fit category one, and category one is when the exact changes recorded in Bod 1602 show up where? In the 1611. Okay? So let's go to page 9 and finish this up. So, observations regarding Psalm 10 and Proverbs 17. Now look, guys, we've looked at two examples here of category one. Are there hundreds of these we could look at? I don't think we need to look at any more for you to get the point, okay? Observations regarding Psalm 10 and Proverbs 17. In addition to providing the 1602 bishops, Bod 1602, and AV readings for these examples, Jacobs includes the readings from all the available pre-1611 English Bibles. His reason for doing so was to demonstrate conclusively that the King James readings were identical to the identical matches to the amended reading found in Bod 1602. So let me show you what I'm talking about here. Here's the example from Proverbs 10. Okay? You can see in the example here from Proverbs 10 that he starts, is that the Psalms one? Psalms 10, let's start there. You can see here that he's got the bishop's reading, then he's got the amendations, and then he has the King James, and then down here he's got Coverdale all the way through showing you what the readings are. Now I did not include all of this in the notes, I'm just telling you why he did that. He did that to prove to you that the amendations here in Bob 1602 are the unique wording choices of who? The King James translators, and not the wording choices of some prior English Bible before the King James. In other words, these readings that they're creating, are they unique to them? They are not just borrowing a reading from another prior English Bible. You following that? So, look at the quote there. The first observation evident from a study of these collated verses is that the only other readings that agree exactly with the amended readings of Psalm 10, 9 through 10, and Proverbs 27:15 are the AV readings. Okay? So in those two cases, what you see in Bob 1602, is it truly their original work? Now, sometimes, are they providing a Geneva reading, or a Tyndale reading, or some other reading as a substitute for what the bishops had? Yes, but in these verses that we're looking at for the examples in this lesson, they're completely original creations of the King James translators themselves. Jacobs concludes, next point. Jacobs concludes his discussion of this class or category of emendations or annotations found in Bod 1602 with the following statement. Please note that Jacobs observes that the Geneva Bible had a heavy influence upon the emendations found in Bod 1602 and thereby upon the AV. These observations highlight the connections between rules 1 and 14 as the translators did their work. Quote, in both verses, influences In both verses, influences that earlier readings have had on the amended and AV readings are present, but they remain only influences. In Psalm 10, 9 through 10, the influence that the Geneva reading has had on the amended and AV readings is undoubtable. But the verb catch that occurs twice in the amended and AV readings has no parallel in the earlier readings. Similarly, in Proverbs 27:15. Though the Geneva reading has had a strong influence upon the amended and AV readings, there is still no earlier reading of this proverb that agrees precisely with the amended and AV readings. I do not intend to say, however, that none of the amended readings has precise parallels with earlier English readings. Quite the opposite is true. Particularly frequent are exact parallels between Geneva readings and amended and AB readings. But the point to stress is that these parallels with other readings, while frequent, are nowhere as numerous as the 90% correlation between amended and AB readings. Now, when he's talking about amended, he's talking about the emendations recorded where? In Bot 1602. Okay? So, additional examples of this class or category of amended readings are provided by Jacob's unpublished doctoral dissertation. Listen, we could go on for 3 weeks if I went through every example that's in the doctoral dissertation. I know you want me to do that, don't you? I'm not going to do that. And I'm talking about just category one here. That statement that I just made is only for category one. Now, next week we are going to look at category two and a couple different types of examples. But we could go on for weeks just looking at category one if we went through every example that Jacobs has in his dissertation, which I'm not going to do. So for those of you that think I exercise no restraint, there's some restraint. Anyway, in the next lesson, we will consider some additional points regarding the connection between the Old Testament annotations found in Bob 1602 and the King James Bible. So we're going to look at examples from the other categories, but we're not going to look at necessarily any more category one examples. Okay? So, we are done here. We have a bit of time. We have a few minutes. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
Well, the King James, there are still some archaic words and maybe differences in meaning if you use today's English compared with that. For example, dropping right there. We would say dripping today.
Right.
And the previous words, thorough and through, we would say through instead of thorough. But there's a lot of other examples like that.
Yeah, there are wording choices in a 1611 that say things the way we would not say them today.
Yeah.
But there's still improvements over, in many cases, what started with what their starting point was in the 1602. And I would add that there are some words in a King James Bible whose meanings have changed over time in the last 400 years. Meanings for words have changed in ways that are maybe not even perceived by a modern reader in the 21st century. Okay? So we have to be careful. This is why we need to look up what words mean. This is why we need to understand or ascertain what words meant at the time the translation was used, which was kind of my point last week in church when we were looking at regenerate and regeneration. And we look at what those words meant at the time the translation was made, it's pretty clear what they meant. There are a lot of words that would fit into that category, okay? Another example would be replenish in Genesis 1. I've talked about this before in this class. Most people, when they see the word replenish in Genesis 1, they think to refill. Like you have your pop, you have a glass of pop at Culver's, and you refill it, you replenish it, right? Well, if you look up the word replenish, at the time, it did not mean to refill, it simply meant to what? To fill. Okay? Now, if you don't know that, and you are ascribing to the word replenish a modern colloquial meaning of the word, you could come to some wrong understandings of what that verse means. Okay? Now, this is not my underhanded swipe at the gap theory. I'm just saying that there's a word there that people think they understand, but if they look up what that word meant at the time the translation was made, they'll realize that it meant something slightly different than the meaning they're ascribing to it now in the 21st century. There are words that are like that. Okay? Any other questions or comments? Look, what we are doing here, I don't know of anyone else who has sat down in a class setting like this and gone through stuff with this level of depth. Okay? I'm showing you here through this work what they did and how they did it and how you literally got your English Bible through the process laid out by the King James translators. To be able to see how they are amending the text into what we have now, to me, is a fascinating thing to look at. And then we're going to look next time at a couple of the other categories of examples from the Old Testament. We'll ultimately then also look at the New Testament, because there are some differences that some notable differences that we need to make sure that we're noting. So, anyone else have a comment or a question? All right. I appreciate your attention. Next week we'll be back and have less.